Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth and Movies. I'm Michael Leader.
I'm Hannah Strong.
And I'm Campbell A. Campbell.
And today we'll be talking about M. Night Shyamalan's high-concept yarn Old, the twists and turns of the Cannes Film Festival, and in Film Club, Claudia Weill's 1978 gem, Girlfriends. All coming up on Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Yes, welcome back, listeners, and welcome back, Hannah. Back from Cannes. I'm sure you're isolating right now.
Yeah. Just about over it now. Just another day, and then I'm free.
Free to go out into the blazing sun. I'm sure you've been missing since coming back from Cannes. We'll be hearing all about your Cannes highlights and lowlights, the pitfalls and everything very shortly. But Camberley, welcome to the show. It's been a while, I think, since you were last on, certainly not since we've relaunched and revamped, and we're using that as an opportunity for all of our returning and regular contributors to reintroduce themselves to the listeners. So, Campbell A. Campbell, who are you?
Who, God, who am I indeed? I'm just thinking of the Jackie Chan, like, who am I? I'm a film critic and TV critic and what have you critic. I'm based in London. I kind of think of myself as omnivorous when it comes to this sort of thing, but I like particularly to write about animation, more on the critical side than like the industry itself, but a lot of anime and things like that, to my joy and shame.
Sadly, we don't have any anime for you this week, but we do have M. Night Shyamalan. What's your history with him? Are you a fan?
Yeah, I have a strange history with him in that it's not so much that I fell out of favor with him in that sort of rocky middle period of his career, in that I just haven't watched any of that stuff. So my opinion of M. Night is quite high because I haven't seen a film of his that I've disliked yet. I've very recently watched The Village for the first time, and my housemate was just like, oh, it's terrible. It's terrible. And he's constantly telling me it's terrible. And I just watched it. I was like, you're wrong. And I left him and my other housemate to argue about that while I went to the movies again. But yeah, I think he's a very interesting visual filmmaker. He always has he's always very playful in his style. Things like The Visit, I think, was really invigorating for found footage. I think The Village, even among its like very deliberate pacing, does some really unnerving stuff with like negative space, and is very romantic. And I think he has this undercurrent of sincerity that grounds his films, as weird as they get, that I think just really clicks into place for me each time. I find him to be one of the more exciting kind of American filmmakers with a budget.
And so we'll find out in moments how his new film Old sounds. So we might as well just kick off the new release section of this podcast then. Let's start off with M. Night Shyamalan's Old. So here's a little bit of synopsis. Of course, no spoilers here. Not much detail at all, really, apart from the high concept behind the film. M. Night Shyamalan unveils a chilling, mysterious new thriller about a family on a tropical holiday who discover that the secluded beach where they are relaxing for a few hours is somehow causing them to age rapidly, reducing their entire lives into a single day. So, Campbell, you were saying just then how your trust levels for M. Night are quite high, having missed out on some of the low the low points in his career. How did Old play for you then?
I have some reservations about it, but I overall had a really great time with it. Mostly just really enjoyed rolling with its deranged energy. It taking its concept and pushing it to the stupidest logical extremes while keeping everything, while making sure that we were all sort of grounded. It was really strange in that it's a very uncanny concept mixed with a lot of explanation. But I enjoyed its vibe. I enjoyed how, again, I enjoyed how playful it was. Like, he's just kind of just putting the camera everywhere. and I don't know, his dialogue is often like a contested part of his films, but at this point so much of Shyamalan's films read as parody to me of sort of a sort of bygone very classical horror, so even when the most ridiculous lines hit, I was just like, yeah, of course, like like it must be the minerals and the rocks. And I was just like, yeah of course it is. There's there's a sincerity and genuinity, that's not a word, I don't know, it's a very I don't know, it's very just on track with what it's saying. It doesn't really second guess itself, which I think is just quite refreshing to me.
Yeah, personally, so to draw back the curtain on this podcast for a second, I've not yet seen Old. In fact, Hannah, Cam, you've both come straight from the screening to give us hot off the press some hot takes on this film. What I like about M. Night Shyamalan is even at his worst, he is playing with toys in the big cupboard of cinematic techniques that you don't often get to enjoy very often anymore. He loves suspense, he loves cliffhangers, high concepts, very much in the vein of Hitchcock, of old school Twilight Zone type storytelling techniques. So there's always something there for me. Hannah, where do you sit with him and his films? Because he had his very quick rise to fame with Sixth Sense, then quick descent into infamy for a good few films, and then with Split and Glass feels like he's now almost on an even keel. Maybe where do you sit?
Yeah, I mean, I when I was younger, I remember we had to watch The Sixth Sense at school when I was in year seven for like a sort of, I think it was they were teaching us about narrative, and I think it is like a good example of like, you know, when you're 11, that film blows your mind. You're like, what? He was a ghost the whole time? Like, you know, you're just kind of like, you can't believe it. And I find him, like, his sort of Wikipedia, IMDb, is very funny to me because it's like, you know, he did his first film, which I've not actually seen, which I think was a comedy called Wide Awake. But then my favourite things on his IMDb are like, yeah, he did rewrites on She's All That and Stuart Little. It's like this guy, like, he just has one of those careers that I find like joyful. Like, he seems like a guy who genuinely loves the movies, and I think sometimes I don't get that impression from people who work with the kind of budgets that he usually commands. I get a sense of them just being kind of like, you know, in it for more the business side, whereas I think M. Night is someone who deeply cares, and like Campbell said, there's a deep sort of sincerity to his work. We did go through a rough patch. I remember going to see Lady in the Water in cinemas, and I hated it so much. I just could not stand that film. And then I, like many people, didn't think The Happening was very good. And I never saw The Last Airbender, but I think like it's university kind of acknowledged that it's very bad. But then I really liked The Visit. And I like, what did I like? Split. I go back and forth on that, on Split. But I actually, yeah, I wrote the review for Glass for Little White Lies. And I think I said in the review that it's like, it's not necessarily a good film, but it is a very like entertaining film. And that is kind of where I fall with Old as well. I think like M. Night makes, I'm always interested in what this guy's up to. I always want to watch his movies. And that is more than you can say for so many filmmakers. I'm always kind of curious. I always know, I always feel like I'm going to have a good time going into an M. Night film.
When, just love seeing him show up in his little cameos. He cannot resist. I was actually just going to say a completely irrelevant fact, but I think one of the last podcasts, the Truth of Movies podcast I did, was about Glass. And I had that very similar thing where it was just like, I knew I was in for a good time regardless. And then, and it was funny that in that my joy in watching Glass came from him setting up this very ostentatious like cinematic universe like so many want to do at the moment, and then just completely just deflates it in the funniest possible manner with that ending, which I don't know if we're beyond the statute of limitations of spoilers on that one, but it's just like the most hilariously downbeat note that it could possibly do. Glass is great. Glass piece, I think.
And I'm sure there isn't much you can tell us about Old before we stray into spoiler territory, perhaps. But maybe to start off with, since he had that comeback with The Visit, where he put his own money on the line, he made a film that could play as a low-budget Blumhouse horror film with a twist, and then Split, for the majority of that film, had a similar, straight-laced feel to it, until in the last moments he brings in Bruce Willis as a cameo, and then Glass, he just says, great, now I can bring all of these films back together, call back to Unbreakable, as you said, Cam, this cinematic universe that he's introducing and subverting. Where does Old land? Is this him on the level, or is this him going full tilt?
I think in a lot of places he swings for the fences again. Narratively, it feels a bit, in places it feels a lot like something he would make, and in places it's a bit unexpected. Like, in some places it's very straightforward, I think, but then in others it does a very similar thing to The Village, in that it builds this sense of mystique around everything that's happening, and it's all very uncanny and weird, and it draws your attention to these things that you're not ever, at points you're not sure if it'll be explained, but then after a point the answers sort of just come tumbling out. And not all of them are very satisfying, and it's not a satisfying thing to witness, having these things answered. And it's like, you feel like you could do with some of the mystery just being preserved. But at the same time, he's just doing this absolutely bonkers stuff with the concept. Like, there's this unbelievable set piece that capitalizes on the fact that it's a beach where people's bodies are rapidly aging, and that includes a lot of different things about the body. So trying to withhold a bit here, but so there's an impromptu surgery that needs to be done, and it's nigh impossible because the body is moving in time so fast that the incision immediately closes up. And he just makes an absolute meal out of that moment and does a lot of it not even kind of showing all of the gory detail. And that's where it comes back into really feeling like an M. Night film for me, where he's doing a lot just with what we don't see. And in that respect, I think teaming him up with, I don't think I can pronounce his surname, but the cinematographer, Mike Gilakis, who worked with Jordan Peele on Us, his past work, it does a lot of similar stuff, where in Us, it was always something out of the corner of your eye. So it just feels like a perfect pairing in these two, and they get getting to play around together and then do some unexpected stuff. Like, it's a lot more chaotic at points than I'm used to. You know what I mean? Where it's like he has these very still films, and this kind of breaks out to these moments of just utter panic, and the camera's sort of racing around in ways that I don't expect from him. So, like, what in putting it shortly, is that it's yes and no for a typical M. Night film. It surprised me in places, and then some bits just, I was just like, this is exactly the kind of thing that I want and expect from a film of his.
Hannah, is this a yes and no film for you, or how do you how does it play for you?
Yeah, that, I think that's like the perfect way to describe it, really, because there are some moments. In fact, there's a kind of the whole, I would say from about 10 minutes in up until maybe around the 50-minute mark, I was kind of like really fully on board, and I think it goes at quite a pace. And like Cambalay says, like the camera work is fascinating because there's so many things happening on this beach. You know, there's three different couples, and then there's the kids as well. And so a lot of things start to happen at once, and the camera's kind of like wheeling around, like following, you know, these different characters running in and out. And there's a wonderful shot where one of them like runs into the cave, and you get like a little bit of like GoPro, I guess, like just a tiny, like not too much, but it did feel very like kind of, oh, okay, very, very random in kind of a fun way. But then for me, like, I know it's a bit of a cliche to expect like a really good twist from M. Night, but I was expecting like a great twist, and I don't think that this film necessarily has that like trademark M. Night like moment where you're like, oh, I can't believe he's done this, like about it, you know. But there were lots of things that I thought were very kind of entertaining, and I will say like full credit to the cast, like, because I think they are like really going for it, even when some of the dialogue doesn't necessarily do them many favors, and there's so much like exposition packed into it that they have to be like, you know, so now we're all aging, oh no. It's just like it is not how human beings talk to one another, but they're all like so deeply committed to it. And I think one of the most impressive things to me was like the casting of the kids. So they have like all the kids at different ages, because obviously they age much more rapidly than the adults, and the likeness is like pretty uncanny. I don't know how they managed to get like such good kind of people that look so similar at different ages, but I was just like marveling at that for a lot of people. I was like, wow, they really do look like they've aged like that amount, rather than like, you know, kind of bad like Benjamin Button-esque prosthetics. They actually did some really great casting.
There was a really it's funny because he's a very funny filmmaker. Like, M. Night's got jokes, like, I will say that much. But there's a very deeply sad thing about the film, and since we're indulging in cliches, it's the maybe the most emotionally accurate reflection of COVID that I have seen, in that the whole it's very on its face that the premise of the film is people having their lives literally stolen from them. You see these kids just like have their lives erased by them, and one just kind of pauses and reflects like, I'm not going to have a graduation. And that just kind of very much struck me as an emotional note. But it's all very, like Hannah said, it's all very heightened, and I think that will go, your mileage may vary with that much. But I did, there is one unimpeachable point in the film, and it's that it's amazing that they called a rapper mid-sized sedan.
It's the way he like, somebody says to him like, what's your name, and he just goes like very sincerely, he goes, mid-sized sedan. And it's like, it's just so funny. And yeah, like Cavalier says, M. Night has got jokes, and like, I think because of how sincere he is in his filmmaking, they really land, because you're just like, oh, okay.
they work even in the moment of this very heightened stress, like one guy just insisting, just like, you, like, look, you guys know I didn't do that. And there's a sort of guilty party that there's some very obvious, I'd hardly call them undertones actually, because there's a very sort of racialized dynamic between one member and a guy who it's the guy who's always saying that he is the chief medical officer, and it's a proper English man, and he has this
It's another Rufus Sewell playing the bad guy role, which he's really good at and does it with such aplomb. And I think in The Father and then in this, it's like, oh, Rufus Sewell, you know, when he comes on the scene, like something shifty is going to happen.
I didn't know where my train of thought was going with that, but I thought it was, even in the moments where he's dealing with very serious stuff, like just this guy's obvious and hateful suspicion of like the only black man on the beach. And it's sort of not even diffused by a one-liner, but that dynamic is emphasized by it. Like, just someone just being like, I don't like this at all. And it works, I think. I think, yeah. I think he's got a very good sense of humour that just carries throughout this film.
So it sounds like there's humour in there, at least. But what scores would we put on this film? Campbell, I'll come to you first. In anticipation, enjoyment, in retrospect.
4 in anticipation, because I love me some M. Night. 4 in enjoyment, because I did have a really great time watching it. Even though it's not long after the screening, I'm maybe thinking a 3 in retrospect, because funnily enough, for a film about aging, you do kind of feel the length a little bit. And it, like I said before, I think it could have stood to lean a little more into its an uncanniness and not feel the need to explain absolutely everything about itself. But I will take him swinging for the fences, like, over your bog standard blockbuster, like, any day of the week.
Hannah?
Yeah, similar scores. I think it's a 4-4-3 for me. I can't say it's one I'm dying to kind of go and see again. And I do think that a lot of his films do have like a rewatch value. I'm really, really eager to rewatch The Village and Signs, which are two that I remember really liking at the time. I'm very into his like Joaquin Phoenix era. But yeah, I just feel like there's maybe something missing here. It does raise some interesting questions that maybe like I don't think we've seen M. Night maybe tackle before, like the idea of kind of not to spoil anything, but there's a whole kind of utilitarian like kind of like sub theme going on, and you know, kind of like, oh, what do we sacrifice in the name of like the greater good? And it's, yeah, it is an interesting film for sure, and I would definitely recommend it to people. I think in a packed cinema, it will play over very well. I think there'll be a lot of kind of like cheering and like gross out like cries. So yeah, but I think like a 4-4-3 for me.
Well, listeners, there you have it. M. Night Shyamalan's latest film, Old, is in cinemas this weekend. If you do watch it and discover its various twists and turns, let us know what you think at the usual channels at LWLIs on Twitter or truthandmovies@tcolondon.com via email. Up next, it's Out with the Old and In with the New, the brand spanking new, that is, with the freshly premiered delights of the Cannes Film Festival.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Yes, Hannah, we talked about this up top. You have just recently returned from the Cannes Film Festival. It sounds like you were really spoilt this year for good films, right?
Yeah, it was. I didn't really know what to expect, because I think, obviously, you know, film festivals have kind of been in a bit of a strange position during COVID. And I don't think necessarily the lineups have been as good as they probably normally would be. I think there's a lot of distributors who are still not so keen on the virtual format, and it's kind of like, well, why would I premiere my film at a virtual festival when I could just put it on my own video on demand platform? So I do get it. But Cannes, yeah, it was after a lot of back and forth and kind of thinking it would get cancelled last minute, it miraculously did go ahead and was a very strong year, I think. Even talking to some kind of more seasoned festival goers, there was a sense that actually they did put together a pretty great lineup, all things considered.
Tell me about these films. Do you have a top five ready to go?
I do. So I'll tell you my favorite thing I saw, and then the other things I think are kind of just like in no particular order. But my favorite thing I saw was The Worst Person in the World, which is the new Joachim Trier film. I think also like deserves an award for being the kind of the best titled film at the festival. I think it's a very funny title for a film. And I'm sure we'll obviously cover this again in upcoming months, but it is a kind of a romantic comedy drama, I would say, about a woman called Julie or Julia. And she lives in Stockholm and she's just navigating her love life, her career. And it's very funny, very touching. I think very, it explores the kind of like divide between millennials and Gen Xers in a way that I thought was very kind of like well observed. And I just had a really good time with it. I wasn't expecting to kind of be as into it as I was. I think that Renata Reinsava, I think that's how you pronounce her name, who plays the lead character, she won the Best Actress Award at Cannes. She's magnificent. I hope that she kind of goes on to a big starry career, even though she looks so much like Dakota Johnson. It is like uncanny. But yeah, that was definitely kind of number one. And then the others, I was a big fan of Titane, the Julia Decona film, which of course won the Palm. Very hard one to kind of talk about without giving anything away, because it's very sort of it's complex but also quite simple in terms of like what happens, but you kind of don't want to dumb it down to its like shockworthy moments, which also have largely been spoiled by people on Twitter who should know better. But yeah, just like, she's someone that I've followed since Raw and was really kind of excited to see her do this amazing sophomore feature. And then the kind of other three, After Yang by Koganada, his again a second feature, which I thought was very impressive, about a family who are kind of mourning their robot family member, which is really great. Paul Verhoeven's Benedetta, which was everyone's been talking about that for years because it's been so delayed. His like non-sploitation romp, which was just the most fun to kind of watch in a packed cinema. It was just an absolute hoot. The man is insane and I really love that for him, love that, full stop. And then Jacques Audiard's Paris, 13th District, which again, like a romantic drama comedy, which I was amazed I liked because I really hated Rust and Bone. So I was quite nervous about him going back to that sort of like romantic territory. But now I thought it was amazing. Another like great new find in Lucy Zhang, who was 19 when she shot this film. She's the lead character. So yeah, and that's like barely scratching the surface. There's so much good stuff. Like Bergman Island was great. The French Dispatch was great. It really just... an embarrassment of riches. Annette, like, yeah, I could go on all day. There's just so many things I saw that I love.
you could go on and on and on. Yeah, and listeners, you can check out lwlies.com for all the reviews from Cannes, from Hannah, Sophie Max Kaufman, Mark Ash, David Jenkins. I wrote a review of the Todd Haynes documentary about the Velvet Underground, which I thought was terrific, but simply was perhaps not as glitzy and as tempting as some of the other films on offer. Campbell, have you been Have you succumbed to any of the Cannes hype? Is there anything that premiered out there that you can't wait to see?
So I've kept my head somewhat buried in the sand out of jealousy because I was previously accredited for Cannes, so I'm just like, I can't hear anyone having a good time. in particular, I'm really excited to see Mamoru Hosoda's Belle. Mamoru Hosoda being an animation director who I really love. Another Cambalay podcast fact, my first little Truth Movies episode was on Mirai, his last film. but he has these running themes of family and like kind of young romance and the internet and how it changes how we interact with each other that have run through his previous work, like Summer Wars, which I really love, and Belle seems like a sort of all of these sensibilities of his dovetailing with each other and with other creators that I love. Like, I know that Tom Moore and Ross Stewart from Cartoon Saloon did background work for the sort of animated world. The architect Eric Wong designed the concepts for it. There's just so many different creative talents working on this feature, and I can't wait. Like, and after the premiere, I think it was like two people I knew who were at Cannes just texted me just being like, you're gonna love it. So hype is through the roof for that. Nobody has been helping. That was that, and then there was another animated film about mountain climbing, which I think people will be less interested in, but it's called The Summit of the Gods, based on a manga by Jiro Taniguchi, and it rocks.
You're speaking my language there. Jiro Taniguchi, I'm a big fan of his manga, and that looks like a really great adaptation. And Belle, you know, I saw Mirai at Cannes a couple of years ago, and it's just great to see her sort of going from strength to strength. Just too much to be excited about, really. All these films coming our way in the next 12 months. Can't wait to see some of them. Hannah, thank you for picking out your highlights. I would ask you for your scores, but it's not film. What scores would you give the Cannes Film Festival? Fives across
the board? I'd give it 5.55. Yeah, it was so good. I'm already messaging my Airbnb host, like saying, hey, can we come back next year? Because I had such a brilliant time.
I would like to go
there.
Well,
we look forward to hearing what you make of the films next year if you do go out there then. So listeners, let us know what you think about any films from Cannes that you're very keen to see. The usual channels. But up next, we're going all the way back to the late 1970s for Film Club this week. Claudia Weill's Girlfriends. So, Girlfriends is back in cinemas this week thanks to Park Circus, and here's a bit of blurb from them. When her best friend and roommate abruptly moves out to get married, Susan, who's trying to be an artist while making ends meet as a bar mitzvah photographer on Manhattan's Upper West Side, finds herself adrift in both life and love. So this film is from the late 1970s, very much with the new Hollywood era where we think we know everything about American cinema at the time, but this is something of a undiscovered, rediscovered gem. It seems to be wheeled out every now and then as one of those must-see films from the period that you've unlikely seen before. Hannah, was this a first watch, a rewatch for you of Girlfriends?
I actually saw it for the first time, I think, in 2017. The BFI did a screening as part of, like, there was some sort of female kind of focused little like weekender. And I went to see it then, and I loved it. I'd never heard of it before. And I took a friend of mine, and we were both just like, what is this movie? Why have we never seen this? Because it really captures something that I think a lot of other films have touched upon since. I think that, like, Frances Ha is probably, like, the closest modern parallel you could get. And I think that Greta Gerwig has said, like, she was inspired to an extent by Girlfriends and by Claudia Weill. But yeah, I think it's just a very well-observed, very funny, very poignant look at, like, female friendship and the way that your kind of lives can diverge in your, like, your 20s and early 30s. I think it's not something that maybe you think about when you're kind of, you think, I've made it to adulthood, that's it now, all my problems are kind of like, you know, I've got my friends and we'll be friends until the end. And then, you know, you realize as, you know, they get older and people start getting married and having babies and moving out of town, and, you know, you choose the other path and they focus on your work. It's just like, it's a very relevant kind of topic, no matter what era you're living in. And I think that gives it this kind of, like, that's probably why it keeps getting wheeled out every few years, because I think it is still, like, very, it feels very contemporary. But then also it is, like, so keenly observing the period it's set in, where women did really have to choose if they wanted to pursue a career or get married and have kids. There was no kind of opportunity to have it all. So I think, like, it's just a very, like, I was gonna say competent, but that sounds like a diss, but that's not, you know, that's not what I mean. I mean, it's just
women
it's,
can make movies,
it's very
too.
Oh god, I'm part of the problem. It's hard to put into words kind of how much it just hits the nail on the head. I think, like, it's, you know, it's one of those films that I, like, love sharing with other people now, especially other women, because I think it is just everyone who's been through this kind of experience, like, even, I mean, I'm sure it applies to men as well, but, like, you know, you're like, oh yeah, this is it, like, Claudia gets it.
Yeah, I was very fortunate to watch this at the BFI when Gemma Desai back then was programming, and she put on a really great screening of this that was very well curated, and all of the program notes and everything situated it in its time, in its era, in its context. But what's amazing is from the first frame how thrilling and contemporary it is as a film, relevant to so many filmmakers that we talk about week in, week out on this podcast. I don't think, you know, Noah Baumbach would have a career if it weren't for films like this. This definitely feels like a forerunner for many of his films, like Squid and the Whale, all the way up to the works he does with Greta Gerwig, or that Greta Gerwig does solo as well. Just even on this rewatch, it made me think a lot about TV series that we're having right now about these individual female characters in the big city, navigating friendships and relationships at that age between the late 20s, early 30s. For, you know, series like, you know, Girls and Russian Doll, I May Destroy You, Starstruck.
I was thinking of Tuca and Bertie.
Tuca and Bertie. Classic.
Bringing animation into the conversation, Cam. That's what you do.
Always.
I didn't realise, I mean, I'm not, like, a big fan of Girls, but I didn't realise until I was doing research for this podcast that Lena Dunham hadn't seen Girlfriends until she already started work on Girls. But then she loved Girlfriends so much, she asked Claudia Vile to direct an episode, and Claudia Vile hadn't worked since 2001 or something. So it was, that's kind of, I think, like, you know, Lena Dunham does a lot of problematic things, but I think, like, giving someone like Claudia Vile an opportunity to kind of come back after, you know, she, from the sound of it, she just kind of, like, never got the opportunities that a lot of her peers got, a lot of her male peers especially. And this was someone who, like, in the, you know, when the film came out, like, Stanley Kubrick was saying this film's amazing, and yet, you know, here she is now all this time later, still people being like, oh yeah, what about Girlfriends? it is just such a injustice that someone could make such an amazing film and it kind of constantly gets held up as, like, an undiscovered gem.
It's so strange that a film that feels like such a bedrock to so many stories about American women just kind of gets lost again, as in, like, there's so many different, it feels like there's generations of women filmmakers who have these beloved films and then disappear, like Daughters of the Dust, Julie Dash, and things,
yeah, like Shel Dunley's The Watermelon Woman as well, like, and it is, like, I mean, it's why it's great that we have people and companies like Park Circus who do kind of make sure these films get out to, like, you know, the big screen again, and hopefully, like, people, you know, young people will go and watch this, and, like, it'll kind of ignite an interest in not only Claudia Vile but, like, other kind of contemporary filmmakers, female filmmakers, and also, like, you know, like Hamlet says, like, Julie Dash and Cheryl Dunier, because I think as much as, like, you know, white female filmmakers have been overlooked, even more so, like, you know, kind of black filmmakers and filmmakers of colour have been even more overlooked. So, you know, I think it's a really important film, and I'm so glad it's getting the love it deserves. But I also think it's, like, we need to kind of keep pushing that forward and make sure that there are more filmmakers who get that treatment. It can't just be the same film getting rediscovered over and over again.
Absolutely. I will make one small shout out. I mean, this is a film of many delights. I love the supporting cast here, particularly the men.
Yeah.
Because as you say, this is an independent film. Claudia Weill made this in sort of fits and starts when she got funding together. Lots of various grants that she put into this. But you wouldn't think that it was a low-budget indie film, because it has, you know, three very recognisable household name actors in Bob Balaban. It also has Eli Wallach during the phase when he, you know, didn't look like Good, the Bad and the Ugly, but he wasn't the ancient man that he is in The Holiday. But then for me, the absolute highlight is Lord Christopher Guest in the years before Spinal Tap and before he, you know, found his own voice as a filmmaker, popping up here as the sort of on-off boyfriend of the main character. So it's those characters are so well cast and so well observed that there's such a tapestry here of delights. Cam, I realise we didn't hear much from you on this. You mentioned Tuca and Bertie. Do you want to quickly elaborate on that and what you thought of the film?
It was mainly in the film's covering of learning how to be alone after forming a very close friendship with someone, which is what struck me about that. Tuca and Bertie is obviously like kind of very colourful, but at its core it is a show that is about these two women learning how to sort of separate their lives from each other, one a little bit more than the other. But it struck me in that sense, and I think it's just generally a very amazing portrait of like what it is to live by yourself in the city. Like, some bits were kind of scary, some bits it's like where you can sort of see our independence flourishing and things like that. And then sometimes when you just bump into weirdos by yourself, like the moment with the taxi driver just being like, it's about time I think that women got treated like first class citizens, I thought was really funny. But I think, yeah, very, like Hannah said, very keenly observed, very often beautiful film.
Well, there you have it, listeners. Claudia Weill's Girlfriend's back in cinemas this weekend, thanks to Park Circus. I think it's a strong recommendation from the three of us. Go and see this, and hopefully it's just one step in your journey of discovering all of these hidden gems in the history of cinema that don't get the limelight they deserve. Let us know what you think if you do see Girlfriends or any of the films we talked about this week. Email truthandmovies@tcolondon.com or tweet us @LWLies. Cam, Hannah, thank you so much for joining me. Next week, we're talking The Suicide Squad. We have music documentary The Sparks Brothers, and director Edgar Wright is popping by to talk music documentaries as well. And Film Club is one of the films that Edgar Wright cites when we asked him what his favourite music documentaries are, and that is Anvil, The Story of Anvil. Subscribe to us wherever you pod, and if your podcast player of choice lets you leave reviews, we'd love it if you left one for us. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.